amid repeated Israeli violations. Here's what he had to say.
It's not really a ceasefire in the literal sense of that phrase. What it is a glorified pause. The Israelis needed a pause for a number of reasons. This came down to the growing PR front, the European and Arab Initiative, which was launched at the United Nations General Assembly, whereby Saudi Arabia and France had put forth their New York Declaration on a Palestinian state, and a number of different diplomatic issues that they were facing. The United States saw this, presented a counterproposal, and also saw that the Israelis were failing to achieve their goals militarily on the ground, or at least their stated goals militarily on the ground through Gideon's Chariots 1, and then the second part to that operation, both of which proved to be failures. So Israel wanted to assess whether they could, during a pause period, implement new agendas to take over the Gaza Strip, to implement a plan of ethnic cleansing, and of course to defeat the Palestinian national resistance. This is something that they've failed to do so far. They will very likely fail to do it in the future.
The Israeli regime continues to violate the Gaza ceasefire agreement with Hamas, killing and injuring more Palestinian civilians, mostly women and children. According to Palestinian Health Ministry, 5 civilians were killed in the latest strikes in Gaza. The new fatalities increased the number of Palestinians killed since the enforcement of the ceasefire to more than 390. Meanwhile, the regime's military vehicles opened fire on civilian homes in the Jabalia refugee camp in northern Gaza. Local sources noted that the Israeli artillery also targeted eastern areas of the city of Khan Yunis in southern Gaza. Earlier, the Israeli Navy abducted 4 Palestinian fishermen while fishing off the coast of Khan Yunis. The regime forces then blew up their boat. According to Palestinian officials, the regime's navy has killed around 230 fishermen since the Gaza genocide started, while abducting about 30 others. The Israeli genocide in Gaza has killed nearly 70,700 civilians, mostly women and children, since October 2023, leaving over 171,000 others injured. The Israeli forces press ahead with their month-long military aggression against Palestinian refugee camps in the occupied West Bank, injuring civilians and demolishing infrastructure. In one of the latest developments, the regime forces issued a military order to demolish 25 Palestinian buildings in the North Shams refugee camp east of the city of Tol Karem. Palestinian officials condemned the move as an extension of the regime's systematic campaign of destruction and forced displacement of Palestinians in Tol Karem and North Shams refugee camps. They called Israel's new order a flagrant breach of international law, urging the international community to intervene. Meanwhile, tensions escalated in the city of Al-Khalil, where Israeli settlers staged a provocative march east of the city as the regime forces closed several Palestinian neighborhoods. Local sources said the march began near the Kiryat Arba settlement. Israeli forces tightened restrictions around the old city of Al-Khalil and the Ibrahimi Mosque, further heightening tensions. Ukraine has said it is open to drop its NATO membership bid as U.S. and Ukrainian officials are to resume their second day of talks in Berlin. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has stated his willingness to forego his country's NATO membership in exchange for receiving security guarantees from the West. He did, however, reject U.S.'s suggestions that Kyiv cede territory to Russia. The negotiations in Berlin have been held under strict secrecy with no media access, but on Sunday, U.S.'s special envoy Steve Witkoff claimed that the talks have achieved a lot of progress. Meanwhile, Russian presidential aide Yuri Ushakov said that Moscow has not yet received any modified peace plan from Ukraine and Europe. He warned that if unacceptable terms concerning territorial issues were proposed, Russia would reject it. A group of protesters have taken to the streets of New Orleans to condemn the arrest of undocumented immigrants by the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents. the arrested immigrants were reportedly working at a local factory. Protesters called for the immediate release and an end to the prosecution and arrest of immigrants. The arrests are the latest in a series of immigration enforcement raids across the country. Immigration arrests under President Donald Trump's administration have continued to rise, surpassing 30,000 per month. Critics say while Immigration and Customs Enforcement is detaining more people overall, its operations are increasingly focused on individuals with no criminal convictions. Earlier this year, major U.S. cities witnessed large-scale protests against the arrest and deportation of immigrants. In some cities, Trump sent National Guard units to help suppress the demonstrations. In Australia, a Muslim bystander who disarmed a gunman during this Sunday's deadly shooting in Sydney has been praised as a hero inside and outside the country. Ahmad Al-Ahmad, a 43-year-old Syrian-born businessman, was filmed wrestling a gun from one of the assailants after they killed at least 16 people and injured 30 others during a Jewish festival. Ahmed himself was injured after the second gunman opened fire at him. Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese praised him as a hero. As the video of Al-Ahmad went viral, social media users also praised his quick thinking and heroic actions. On Monday, hundreds of people also gathered at the site of the incident to lay flowers and pay tribute to the victims. For more on this, I'm now joined by Nahid Borisov, joining us from our Tehran studios. Very good to have you on the program, Nahid. Well, how might the fact that Ahmad Al-Ahmad, a Muslim, risk his life to protect Jewish community and the festival attendees reshape narratives around interfaith solidarity in the world and in Australia in particular?
Well, he's not only Muslim. He's also about, he's from the 11th area of West Asia, Syria, Palestine, Lebanon. And that is very important to raise and to highlight, because at the same time that everyone is condemning the massacre in Sydney, there are also biased Zionists that using this opportunity to attack the cause of Palestine and to say whoever is calling what is happening in Palestine as genocide is behind the incident in the terror attack in Sydney. And this is a very horrific moment for the entire world because everyone for 2 years, they were witnessing the genocide in Gaza. People were coming to the street for justice for the Palestinians. And same people are also against such a terror happening in Sydney against civilization. And now what we are seeing is also not only about Palestine. Israel is taking the opportunity to attack Iran, saying that Iran is behind such a terror. First of all, there is no logic for Iran to do such a thing. But also, why the Israelis, why the Zionists, for 1 second, do not think about allowing people to actually mourn and to be upset about the incident, the very terror that just happened a day ago. And it just shows that every single opportunity for them all around the world, they don't lose it to just attack the Palestinian cause or to attack the Iranian government. And at the same time, we have many people are raising their voice saying that, okay, we are against what happened yesterday, but we are also against the propaganda against Palestinians and against the people who are protesting for Palestinian cause, and also what they are talking about Iran. And to be very honest, Australia is a very multicultural country. They experience they had many, many beautiful big rallies for 2 years to force the government to recognize the state of Palestine. And then what happened after was actually very interesting for people to see that all of a sudden they decided to say Iran was behind the attacks on the synagogue, on the two synagogues that happened a year before. And then they decided to shut down the Iranian embassy and to cut the ties with Iran. And now there is another incident, and again the name of Iran is rising. And also, of course, it's about Islamophobia. And it's about the moment that all these people that are full of hatred against the West Asian people in general and also Muslim people, using this opportunity to attack Islam, to attack Muslim people. And then we have a very interesting moment to see a person who is also from West Asia coming to save people, coming to save lives. And he was very courageous. Everyone is like, wow, this is very interesting to watch someone with no weapons coming to the gunfire, like, to be very honest, and just taking out the weapon and helping people to actually run away. And then he was injured, and he is Muslim, and he is from Syria, from the very land that is very close to the Palestinian land.
Thank you, Nahid. That was Nahid Puri, analyst, joining us from our Tehran studios. The preliminary results from Chile's runoff presidential vote show the far-right candidate of the Republican Party has won the election. Chile's electoral service says José Antonio Kast has won a support of over 58%, with more than 99% of the votes counted. Janet Tahara from Chile's ruling left-wing coalition came in second with nearly 42% of the votes. Jara has conceded defeat in the polls, but who had failed to meet the 50% threshold to become president in the first round, which was held on November 16th. It has been 10 years since Nigerian security forces launched an attack on the worship center of the Islamic movement in Nigeria and killed hundreds of members and destroyed property. Danjum Abdullahi filed this report on the anniversary of the gruesome incident known as the Zaria Massacre.
This conference was one of the events organized to remember over 340 members of the Islamic movement who were murdered when soldiers of the Nigerian army attacked the home of Sheikh Ibrahim al-Zazaki and the worship center of the Islamic movement in December 2015. Participants at this conference described the 2015 Zaria massacre as a crime against humanity and of historic magnitude, which was committed by a few agents of the Nigerian state. Hundreds of men, women, and children were shot and buried in mass graves.
I lost five children, three of which are biological, two of which are adopted. They were orphans, and we took them in and were taking care of them. The five of them have not been found. Nothing about them were heard of. We just don't know how to explain the situation because of the excruciating pain in our hearts.
Mourners said that identity, faith, and religious conviction cannot be erased through violence. Speakers affirm that the Islamic movement is deeply rooted in an enduring struggle for justice and an unwavering resistance to tyranny, forces that cannot be silenced or extinguished.
The Zaria massacre made our call known to the whole world. Remember, in all continents of the world, there were demonstrations demanding our religion. They knew what happened. Remember, in India, it went to the extent that the Prime Minister of India was saying that, why don't you release that celebrity?
A decade after the heinous massacre in Zaria, members of the Islamic movement continue to await justice and the prosecution of those responsible. Human rights organizations argue that the Nigerian government's attempt to conceal the atrocity reflects a profound disregard for human life and a blatant evasion of accountability.
We expected that indicted individuals and groups should be prosecuted, particularly the military commanders who gave the order. We also expected government haven't been given the names and identities of the victim, to take steps towards restitution and compensation. Nothing has been done.
Participants at this conference said tyrants don't realize that abuse of power weakens their own system. They explained that moral leadership endures as the era of every political actor eventually finishes. Danjuma Abdullahi, Abuja.
And that is a wrap for this hour's news. Thank you so much for staying with us. And until next time, it's goodbye from me, Bahman Roy. We'll be right back.
Throughout history, mosques have always been serene havens for Muslim worshippers. Magnificent buildings have developed significantly during the years, and their unique and one-of-a-kind architecture has fascinated people throughout history. Iran is adorned with glorious mosques that invite you to a divine feast of colors, each reflecting the genius of their architect and the amount of skill and proficiency that goes into each and every detail. In Tehran, mosques are found on nearly every street corner, making it easy for Muslims to attend the daily prayers. The Imam Khomeini Mosque, located right inside the Tehran Bazaar, is one of the oldest structures in the city, dating back to the early 18th century. People in different parts of the bazaar have easy access to the courtyard, and so many retreat to this calm shelter for their daily prayers. Inside the mosque, one is spellbound by the amount of color that has gone into the intricate tiles decorating all the arches and niches. The elaborate geometric designs that adorn the walls and ceilings are also something to reflect on.
The architecture of mosques in the country vary from one region to another, depending on culture, heritage, and the resources available. Now, these buildings are different from each other in terms of color, the various symbolic patterns, and the different styles of tile work. But there are a few common elements that most of these mosques share with each other.
One of the common features of every mosque is the mihrab, a niche in the wall that indicates the direction towards which Muslims pray. Although the mihrab varies in size, they all have intricate arabesque and calligraphy designs made by joining numerous cut glazed tiles.
Beautiful pools has always been an inseparable part of the mosque because water is known for its purity, brightness, and transparency. Water has always been associated with the divine and also known as a purifying element.
The history of tile work in Iran goes back to the prehistoric period, but it was in the Islamic era that this unique art flourished and became the most important decorative feature of religious buildings. For Muslims, these floral patterns in distinctive colors, especially turquoise, deep blues, and rich reds, represent the infinite and convey a sense of spirituality.
Dignified, magnificent, and impressive. The architecture of the mosques in Tehran reflect creativity and beauty. Every tiny little detail creating an atmosphere of holiness and spirituality.
Apart from the floral designs, exceptional calligraphy works are also displayed on these tiles. Calligraphy is closely linked to geometry because the proportions of the letters are all governed by mathematics. Most mosques have some type of service inscription, which might be a verse from the Quran, lines of poetry, or names and dates. Sometimes a single word such as Allah or Muhammad are written. repeated and arranged into patterns over the entire surface of the walls. The two other common features in most mosques are the minarets and domes. Minarets are tall towers that not only provide a visual focal point, but are also used for the call to prayer. Domes are also one of the signature forms in Islamic architecture, symbolically representing the vault of heaven.
One of the well-known mosques in Tehran's Chariati Street is Husseiniyeh Ershad, which was built half a century ago. This mosque is well known for all the political and historical events that happened here during the course of the years.
Our way of living changes as the years go by, but some things in life stay the same. People come, people go, but they remain standing. The architecture of the mosques in Iran is part of eternity, echoing the glorious image of God in its every detail and corner. Hoda Lezgi for Iran.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.
From Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome, everyone. For years, they lecture the world on the rules-based international order, on property rights, on legal sovereignty, on the sanctity of law. Now, in a move of hypocrisy, the European Union, under the heavy hand of Washington, has simply stolen what is not theirs, $246 billion. Russian sovereign assets seized frozen under a fabricated, quote, emergency. They dress this theft in the language of morality, of supporting Ukraine, but do not be fooled. This is an act of economic warfare, a desperate escalation by a failing bloc tearing up its own legal scriptures to serve a master across the Atlantic. It has shattered European unity with its own members crying rape of law, and it has been promised with a fierce and justified retaliation from Moscow. In this Spotlight episode, we cut through the Western propaganda. We ask who truly ordered this, how deep are the cracks in Brussels, and is this the final foolish blow to any chance of peace? But first, let's get more details in this report.
The European Union has indefinitely frozen Russia's assets in Europe over the Ukraine war.
Using a special procedure meant for economic emergencies, the bloc's governments agreed to immobilize $246 billion, worth of Russian sovereign assets until Moscow ends the war and compensates its neighbor for the damage caused in the conflict. It's a key step that will allow EU leaders to work out at a summit next week how to use the tens of billions of euros in Russian central bank assets to underwrite a huge loan to help Ukraine meet its financial and military needs over the next 2 years. The move has caused rifts within the EU. Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban slammed the decision, accusing the European Commission, which prepared the measure, of, quote, systematically raping European law. He said the move means the rule of law in the European Union comes to an end, and Europe's leaders are placing themselves above the rules. Slovakia has also criticized the measure, warning that the use of frozen Russian assets could directly jeopardize efforts to end the Ukraine war. Russia's central bank, meanwhile, said it has filed a lawsuit in Moscow against Euroclear, a Belgian financial group that holds the majority of Russian assets. In a separate statement, the central bank also described wider EU plans to use Russian assets to aid Ukraine as illegal and contrary to international law, arguing that they violated the principles of sovereign immunity of assets. Russian officials have also repeatedly said that tapping the frozen assets would be met with the harshest reaction. The legal battle over frozen funds is taking place as the United States pushes for a ceasefire deal between Moscow and Kyiv. A draft U.S. peace plan released last month envisioned using the frozen funds for the post-war reconstruction of Ukraine. As a result, their use by European leaders for a loan before a peace deal could cause tension with Washington. But European officials say the alternative is for Ukraine to face a financial crunch. Analysts believe the asset freeze reveals that the bloc is willing to bend its own rules when politically convenient, eroding the very legal order it claims to uphold and exposing deep fractures within the bloc.
Well, in this episode, we are joined by Mr. Larry Johnson, a former CIA analyst, joining us from Florida, U.S. And Mr. Gilbert Doctorow, independent international affairs analyst, joining us from Brussels, Belgium. Well, gentlemen, I'd like to thank you very much for joining us during this episode of Spotlight. And Mr. Doctorow, let's go ahead and start off with you. Let's start off with this whole legitimacy on the so-called economic emergency procedure, as they're calling it. Now, some people are describing it as a not-so-simple legal loophole, while others are calling it outright theft of a sovereign nation's sovereignty. I mean, what side would you lean to? Obviously, what's in front of us of basically this over these hundreds of billions of euros, of dollars, excuse me, being stolen by the EU?
Well, let's take this in two steps. What happened on Friday was step one. That is that Ursula von der Leyen put before the member states of the European Union a proposal to end the six-monthly renewals of sanctions against Russia, which had within it the freezing of assets. That was done as a first measure to prepare the way for collateralization of a large loan, a loan in the amount of 145 billion euros, to be paid out in two annual portions of 45 billion each, and the remainder to be used to pay off a G7 loan to Ukraine that has fallen due. Now, step one, I say, because if the frozen assets could be ordered released as a result of failure at the six-month intervals to find unanimity and to continue the sanctions, then that would vitiate the basis for having these funds held in collateral. To avoid that, in the anticipation that at least one member state, namely Hungary, would at some point veto the extension by 6 months, they put this to a vote, and von der Leyen won. But I say this is only step one, and it's procedural. It was simply to put in place the holding of those assets, and with the purpose of their being removed from the grips of Mr. Trump, and thereby giving leverage to the European Union in the ongoing negotiations over peace, from which it has been sidelined. So I see the principal importance of what happened yesterday, which was approved, and was even approved by Belgium, which has been the most vocal opponent of the whole notion of collateralization for purposes of a loan to Ukraine. It passed because it was dealing with securing a place at the negotiating table for Europe, period. The big issue, and which is completely uncertain how voting will go and procedurally how von der Leyen will handle it, is still ahead. That's when the European Council, which is the second executive body of the European institutions, whereas the European Commission is the executive carrying out the daily activities of acting as a cabinet. The European Council meets on big issues. It meets once a month, and it consists of the 27 heads of state and heads of government of the European Union.
Yes, and Mr. Doctorow, if you don't mind me cutting you off right there, I would like to go ahead and bring in our guest from the U.S., of course, Mr. Johnson. Thank you very much for your patience. Mr. Johnson, let's talk a bit about, I mean, basically they violate the principle of the sovereign asset immunity. Now, what precedent has the West now actually even put into play? I mean, does what stops any other nation at this moment from seizing any European, any American assets in the future under their own declared, quote, emergencies, or would that even be different in the European and the Americans' own eyes as not acceptable because it's them being attacked here?
Well, this has the potential to set off a whole chain reaction. In fact, we started to see it with Russia has now filed a lawsuit against Euroclear. I believe it's in a Russian court, but Russia was prepared, for this step. Russia has the potential to seize a variety of European assets. They've avoided doing so because the Russians, in contrast to the Europeans, are much more committed to trying to uphold international law. But all of this, I think, is taking place in the context of we're witnessing a fundamental shift in the international economic order that was established at the end of World War II. Then the United States has been the de facto leader of that for the last 80 years. But now with the rise of BRICS, with the increased cooperation between Russia and China, we're seeing that that whole system starting to unravel because the ability of the West to use economic financial terms as a bludgeon, as a coercive lever over other states is starting to slip. Recall that it was 10 years ago that Russia and China agreed with the West to impose sanctions on Iran. And now, in the wake of the snapback sanctions, Russia and China both said, nah, we're not doing that anymore. We're going to support Iran. So this is a last desperate play by the Europeans, and frankly, in the whole context of the war in Ukraine, it's not going to make one bit of difference.
And Mr. Doctor, I mean, let's move over a bit to these EU rifts, to this hypocrisy being taking place at the moment. Analysts are saying that this reveals that the EU bends its rules when politically convenient. But doesn't this finalize the bloc's transformation from, let's say, a community of law to a mere geopolitical tool for Washington, or has it always been a tool for Washington, in your opinion?
Ahead of the facts. I told you about step one. Step one doesn't violate anything. It's simply enshrines in perpetuity what existed till now on a six-month basis. The Russian assets have not been touched. The Russian assets will not be touched when they meet on the 18th and 19th. These are separate issues, but it's very important to make distinctions here to understand why people are voting the way they are. The second step would happen on the 18th and 19th of December, and that is to invoke the same principle of qualified majority, not at unanimity, to vote on the principle of using these assets to open a loan to Ukraine. That already is the point where the assets are touched. Now, as regards the danger of this, it's not just a question of hollow hypocrisy and saying that the European Union doesn't live up to the standards. There's something much more important going on here, and it could lead to the collapse of the global financial system. My colleague has said correctly that the Russians have put a legal action against the holdings that are in Russia and owned by Euroclear. So it's not just the Russians had deposited one way into Euroclear, but Euroclear also keeps deposits with those countries that it deals with. And the Russians are now saying, much more important than the 18 billion euros in Euroclear assets that the Russians can seize at any time they want, more important than that, the Russians are issuing an announcement to the global community to seize Euroclear assets wherever they are. Now, what does this mean, and what is Euroclear? Belgium is a small country, and people would think normally that Euroclear is small also. Wrong. Euroclear has $43 trillion in assets under its care. If that starts to wind out, if there is an attack on its assets, which put its financial well-being in jeopardy, then the whole system unravels, and you have a global financial crisis. So what Mrs. Neal speak about the Europeans, let's be very specific. This is an initiative coming from very few people who are usurpers of power, who are essentially dictators. And the dictator number one is Ursula von der Leyen. She is the one who hatched this idea and is pursuing it with a vengeance. So before we pin the blame on the whole of Europe, you have to look at who is actually the agent of this crime.
Well, as you did point out there, Mr. Doctorow, the situation is definitely more deeper than anyone is expecting. We have to look at the financial part. We have to see the history behind this. Mr. Johnson, I mean, I know we've seen a lot of your analysis on other shows and, of course, everything that you do. I would like to get your opinion on the situation, the significance of the timing specifically about this so-called economic emergency procedure. Is it have any relation to the very fast advancements by the Russian forces there on the ground, in your opinion, or does that have nothing to do with it?
No, it absolutely does. And as Gil correctly noted, I mean, this is an act of utter desperation by the Europeans. It just shows how they don't have any other playbook to go to, because the advance of Russia right now is so comprehensive, so sweeping and so fast that there is literally nothing that the Europeans can do. Even if they, quote, were going to mobilize to send troops to Ukraine to fight alongside the Ukrainians, they'd be months trying to get their act together on that front. And Gil correctly notes that this poses the potential to unravel the Western-dominated financial system. Because once you destroy faith in an institution's ability to protect your assets, people start going elsewhere. And ultimately, it is the belief that they're going to follow the law, that they're not going to play personal politics. I mean, for goodness sakes, during World War II, my understanding is even though Western banks held assets, financial assets of Nazi Germany that the West was at war with, they still protected those assets. And now here, and just to give you some measure of the desperation, they're willing to throw all of that aside. And again, it'd be one thing if they could say, well, if we take that $300 billion, by God, that's going to stop the Russian advance, and it's going to actually force them to retreat. That's not the case.
Well, with that, Mr. Doctorow, I mean, you were talking a moment about who is at fault here. The funds are meant to, quote, as they mentioned, underwrite a loan to Ukraine. Is Europe essentially making the Ukrainian people indebted for decades? I mean, they're coming over money that isn't even theirs to give. How is this going to affect the Ukrainians?
You know, the wording of this loan does not envisage the kind of threat to Ukrainians' interest that you are raising now. It states that the loan falls due at the moment that the Russians pay for the damage they've caused. And the Russians will never pay for the damage they've caused because they're the winners of this war. So this is why it is a transparent confiscation of assets. But the Ukrainians as such will receive the money, will spend the money, will steal the money, and will have no obligation to repay. That is inherent in this deal. Everyone is talking on two sides of their mouth. Mr. De Wever has been extremely brave in risking the wrath of all of the other 26 member countries, 25 member countries, because Hungary certainly would not be angry about what he's doing. But he has gone up against almost all of his colleagues and said in this declaration that was issued yesterday by four countries, Belgium, Bulgaria, Italy, and Malta. They all said that voting for that waiver of the unanimous voting procedure yesterday, but we can be sure they will not approve application of the same limited majority when it comes up for a vote on applying for a loan against this on the 18th and 19th. Mr. De Wever made firm statements that he supports Ukraine to the end. That's what he says to the European Commission, to look like one of the boys. When he speaks in Belgium, as he did last week, he spoke in French to a gathering in one of the major auditoriums in the center of the city. He said something quite different, that the idea that Ukraine could win this war is a fairy tale and an illusion. He also said to the editor of the major French-speaking newspaper in this town that for Russia to lose this war is not a good idea, considering it's the world's biggest nuclear power, if you follow with the dots lead. So there is a lot of behind-the-scenes maneuvering here, and it's very it's risky to make facile generalizations about what European leadership thinks. But I think the real issue, when Mr. De Wever and his three colleagues said that they oppose the use of the Russian assets for purposes of a loan, they said, oh, we could do something more constructive. We can give a European loan out of our own pockets for that money. He's saying that tongue-in-cheek, knowing that no European country other than Germany is willing to pony up 2 euros to help Ukraine because they'd have to go to their parliaments. That is the real trick here. This, von der Leyen has done, is to count on the violation of democracy across the whole of the EU, not just in parliament, which she oversees, because it means that money will be put up by European governments without going to their parliaments.
Well, exactly, and Mr. Doctorow, as you did mention, I'd like to thank you for clarifying those points in our procedure. As we were mentioning, sometimes we've got to make it very clear to the viewers what is actually meant behind the scenes, behind the ink on the paper, if we may. Mr. Johnson, we have around 4 to 5 more minutes. Let me go ahead and get in a few more questions, if we could. Let's just focus a moment on this Russian response / retaliation. They said that it's going to be harsh. Now, they promised this. What kind of form could we perhaps expect other than what they did to there in Russia? Are we looking at symmetrical seizures of remaining Western assets in Russia, or are we perhaps maybe something asymmetrical, economic, maybe a diplomatic warfare? What are you expecting? What kind of reaction from Russia?
Well, Russia is going to follow. They're going to follow legal procedure. They're not going to act recklessly. They're certainly not going to react emotionally. And we saw the first step of it with the legal action, the filing of the suit against Euroclear that was taken, I believe, yesterday. Going forward, if the Europeans actually move ahead and seize assets, the Russians have made provisions to seize European assets that are still in Russia. And what's interesting is, despite now 3, going on almost 4 years of war, and several provocations, continued provocations by the West, particularly by Europe, Russia has not gone after those assets because they still put value in the notion of doing things legally, trying to uphold international law, and trying to ensure that there's some sort of order in the system. It's the West that has continually been walking away from agreements and violating the laws. As you said in your opening, it's almost like, it's the golden rule. Those with the gold get to make the rules. And from the United States standpoint, they said, well, we got all the gold, so we're going to make the rules. And that turns out not to be the case. But, I think Russia's well prepared to retaliate, but they're going to do it unemotionally and legally.
Well, Mr. Doctorow, with the last few minutes, I'd like to go ahead and direct my last question towards you. We have to bring up this draft peace plan being brought up by the U.S. Now, they envisioned it using frozen assets for post-war reconstruction, according to them. By jumping the gun, basically, and using them now for this war funding, has Europe just sabotaged Washington's own peace roadmap, or is everything we see planned? Was there even a peace plan at the beginning?
No, you just identified the logic. It's to sabotage the American peace deal.
And with that, I do have just one more question. If you could each answer it in around 30 to 40 seconds, your own words. Ultimately, how will this actually accelerate the global move away from the dollar, the euro-dominated assets, towards alternatives, perhaps among the BRICS nations, around others, who are wary of the Western financial weaponization? For 30 seconds, please, Mr. Johnson, in your own words.
Yeah, well, it's a further reaffirmation that the West is not to be trusted, that the West is a bully, and that they're going to use it whatever economic leverage they have over them. So therefore, the global South, Russia and China, they're moving as quickly as they can to separate themselves from that.
And Mr. Doctorow, your answer, please.
The bottom line is the pitch that the advertiser of a talk show, both Larry Johnson and I participate in, my goal.
Well, with that, I'd like to thank both of our gentlemen for joining us during this episode of Spotlight. From Florida, USA, Mr. Larry Johnson, a former CIA analyst, and of course, as always, Mr. Gilbert Doctorow, independent international affairs analyst there, joining us from Brussels, Belgium. A pleasure to have you both with us. Well, until next time, goodbye. Thank you.
Welcome back, dear listeners. Here's a glimpse of what's coming up next on our schedule. For this hour, it's time to listen to For Humanity, hosted by Hujjatul Islam Hamza Azizi. This program covers a variety of subjects concerning human being in the Noble Quran, which include individual and social issues such as the family and how to interact with other faithful Muslims from the point of view of the Holy Quran. And after this program, we shift our focus to economic divide. If you're interested in economic or business issues, then this program is definitely for you. Top experts on the economy give expert analysis and commentary on the biggest business and economic stories of the day. Finally, we present Spring of Truth. Spring of Truth features English translations of selected powerful statements and speeches from the founding father of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini. May Allah bless his soul. Please stay with us. Up next is For Humanity.
وَقَضَى رَبُّكَ أَلَّا تَعْبُدُوا إِلَّا إِيَّاهُ وَبِالْوَالِدَيْنِ إِحْسَانًا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except him, and he has enjoined kindness to parents.
For Humanity.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Salam alaikum. This is Hussein, and you're listening to a program for humanity from IRIB English Radio. In this program, we talk about Islamic teachings pertaining to humanity and mankind. And in the previous episodes, we started covering a very good book in this regard titled A 250-Year-Old Man. It's a combination of the lectures delivered by His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. And the first chapter of the book was about the life story of the Prophet. We talked about the challenges of the Prophet and the personal characteristics. And we ended up talking about the triumphant return of the Prophet to Mecca and the incident of Ghadir. In order to contextualize the incident of Ghadir, we decided to talk a little bit about Hajjatul Wada, the last pilgrimage performed by the Prophet ﷺ, and the Sermon of Mina. Arguably the most important lecture that the Prophet delivered, or one of the most important lectures that he delivered towards the end of his life in the presence of Muslims all around Arabian Peninsula. Because, yes, you have the cases, in other cases, that the Prophet ﷺ delivers lectures or talks and his will in the presence of his companions in Medina. But this occasion, in addition to the occasion of Ghadir, it is important because all Muslims from all around the Arabian Peninsula are there in Mecca. And it is their direct encounter with the Prophet. Some of them, this is the last, or some of them even the first and the last direct encounter with the Prophet. So this is extremely important. And the Sermon of Mina includes topics pertaining to a struggle in the way of Allah, unity among Muslim community, that all the values of the era of Jahiliyyah, the values of paganism, are now nullified under the feet of the Prophet. And the next thing that he says is that all the financial things that were not Islamic, that were un-Islamic,